the screams of Sinner 42, loud enough to bust your brains out. The opposition's tongue is cut in two. Keep off the streets, cause you're in danger. 100,000 despidos lost in the jails in South America. Curl up, baby. Curl up tight. Curl up, baby. Keep it all out of sight. Undercover. Keep it all out of sight. Undercover. Undercover. Undercover of the night. The sex police are out there on the streets to make sure past laws are not broken. The race militia has got itchy fingers all the way from New York back to Africa. Curl up, baby. Curl up tight. Curl up, baby. Keep it all out of sight. Undercover. Undercover. Undercover.
That was a section of Undercover of the Night from Bernard Fowler's new album Inside Out. Bernard Fowler is my guest on this episode of the Burning Ambulance Podcast. Hello, I'm Phil Freeman, and welcome to the Burning Ambulance Podcast, which is part of the OSIRIS Network. Visit the OSIRIS page on jambase.com to check out all of our other shows. There are about 30 of them on all sorts of subjects, and the network continues to grow, so I'm sure there are at least a few others that will be of interest to you as well. If you enjoy this podcast, I hope you'll consider supporting us on Patreon. It's patreon.com/burningambulance. We ask just $5 a month, and it'll really help us to create more and better content, so become a subscriber if you can. Bernard Fowler is originally from Queens and came up in New York's underground dance music scene right at the moment in the early 80s when disco and funk were starting to be replaced by hip-hop and electro. He was in a group called the Peach Boys, who had some singles that were big on New York radio and in the clubs. But at the same time that the group was kind of peaking and dissolving, Fowler made a much more crucial connection for his long-term career, hooking up with Bill Laswell. In the 80s and afterward, Fowler sang on a huge number of Laswell productions, including Herbie Hancock's Future Shock, Yoko Ono's Star Piece, Mick Jagger's She's the Boss, PIL's album, Sly and Robbie's Language Barrier and Rhythm Killers, Swan's The Burning World, and many more. He also became the singer for Tackhead in the late 80s for two albums, and worked a little bit with Living Color and the Black Rock Coalition. For the last 30 years, he's also been a member of the Rolling Stones touring band, and appeared on albums like Bridges to Babylon and Voodoo Lounge, as well as the various guys' solo projects. He's on Keith Richards' Main Offender, and he actually produced Ron Wood's Slide on This. He's also made two solo records before this one, but Inside Out is something very different from anything he's done before. What he's done here is taken Rolling Stones songs and totally transformed them into Gil Scott-Heron / Last Poets style spoken word pieces, with entirely new musical backing. It's mostly percussion with just a little bit of horns and guitar. So This interview covers a lot of ground. We talk extensively about his work with Laswell. We then dive into his time with the Stones and Tackhead and his own stuff, and about a few of the rock bands he's fronted over the years. He's also the only person I've ever spoken to who's worked with both Bill Laswell and Adrian Sherwood, so we discuss the similarities and the differences between their working methods as well. I'm going to play one more piece of music now. This is a version of Sister Morphine from Inside Out, and that's Keon Harold, who was on the podcast last October on trumpet. And right after that, you'll hear my interview with Bernard Fowler. You're originally from Queens, right?
That's right, Long Island City, Queens.
Did you come from a musical family, and like, when did you start singing, and sort of in what context? Was it like church, school?
A musical family. I heard music growing up. I used to play my mother and father's records. None of them, neither one of them were a professional musician. My mother sang in choir growing up. She grew up in the South, North Carolina. Not in the traditional sense. I'm not from a musical family. I never sang in church. Mm-hmm. I never sang in church. I always loved singing. I sang in my house, sang in the hallways of the building, as a young kid. I did sing in, the school glee club, but I think I probably got, the best training from the radio.
Now, speaking of that, you were in your... I think I have this right, if I'm guessing your age right. You were in your late teens, early 20s, as the culture shifted from like disco and funk to early hip-hop and electro. So
What was your feeling about that? Can you remember what you thought about rap when it was like just starting to come out of Queens and the Bronx?
I was in the middle of it. I used to do a lot of work with Bill Laswell and Celluloid Records.
Mm-hmm.
And so I sang on a lot of early hip hop records. And what I thought about it, I thought it was a cool new genre. It was the people that were the, you know, people like myself that grew up in, you know, the urban environment, you know, finally had a genre of music that gave them a voice. Early hip hop was like, you know, music of the people. You know, it wasn't like it was now, you know, where everybody's, you know, wants to talk about bitches, hoes, and money. You know, we were talking about, or they were talking about, you know, things that were going on in the neighborhood. It was more of a socially conscious genre back then.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I thought it was a cool thing.
Your group, the Peach Boys, was very different from anything else that was going on in disco and dance music generally in the early 80s. So, I mean, tell me a little bit about that project and how it started and whether it achieved everything you set out to achieve with it.
Well, the Peach Boys started because the drummer from the Peach, well, you know, I started out in a band called the Total Eclipse.
Uh-huh.
And Total Eclipse, you know, members would come and go, and one particular, two members in particular, you know, the drummer, Stephen Brown, and bass player Darryl Short, they were leaving the band, and I saw myself leaving the band, you know, also. And so, you know, Stephen called me one day and you know, we talked about putting together another band, and he had some people that he wanted to introduce me to. So he took me to 30th Street to a loft where I met pretty much the rest of the guys, Benedictus, Brody Williams, who was from, he was from Ghana, West Africa, West Africa, and Brody and I wrote, you know, most of the songs.
Mm-hmm.
And then came the guitar player, Robert Casper. Robert Casper was, I think he was living in Hawaii, you know, playing in show bands down there. And so, you know, again, Stephen Brown was responsible for bringing us together. But even before that, so Stephen Brown brought us together. Now, hip hop is, you know, it's bubbling. You know, you got the Curtis Blow, the DJ Hollywoods, and, you know, stuff like that. And there was a club, 371, uptown in the Bronx,
mm-hmm.
where a lot of that was going on. And Stephen, you know, Stephen Brown had an idea that we would, you know, that we should cut it. We should put it on wax. So he borrowed some money from his father. And we went to a studio, RPM Studio, down on 14th Street and Union Square. I don't know if it's still there. And I went to Stephen's house and we sat there and we wrote this song. The song was called Rock Mr. DJ. Up until that point, there was no rap records. Up until that point, there were no rap records, and we had cut this song. And it was a combination of, you know, a song, you know, with me singing and, you know, a rap break. So we cut the song. Okay, and then, you know, we went on to concentrate on putting this band together, the Peach Boys. Mm-hmm. And it just worked out, the Peach Boys worked out to the way it was. We wanted it, you know. We were all into funk, you know. That's the stuff that we grew up on. And, you know, so you got hip-hop. You got hip-hop, you know, funk, which had never really died. And then you got dance music, club music. We were trying to bridge all of that, and I remember having a conversation with them where it was important that we needed rock guitar. We needed a rock guitar element to make it a little different from everything else that was going on. Because then, again, you know, a lot of dance music did not have any rock guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And also during that time was the invention of the drum machine. And we were lucky enough, I guess you could say that we were lucky enough to have one in our arsenal. That was a blessing and both a curse, because that drum machine kind of killed the drummers.
Mm.
It killed the drummers' fire. You know, they said that they would say at the time that the drum machine was going to put a lot of drummers out of business. We were definitely a victim of that. But we were a victim of that. But the Peach Boys, I think the Peach Boys did. We were able to change dance music. So yes, we did exactly what we were supposed to do. And because I almost forgot, but in putting together the Peach Boys, you know, in trying to get the Peach Boys listened to, we would talk and we realized, you know, there was the Paradise Garage that was happening, and the playlist from the Paradise Garage is what they were playing on radio. So we went down and tried to meet Larry. We actually did meet Larry. And Larry came on board. After some time, Larry came on board, and now we have the first celebrity DJ as part of our band. Pretty much, and you know, he mixed the records and, you know, played the records, and he played the console as we were doing shows.
Mm-hmm.
He was part of it. And like they say, all good things come to an end, and that good thing was, ooh, man, it was on its way out. It was on its way down, you know. Success and money have a way of changing people, and it changed the Peach Boys in the worst way.
Yeah. It seems like, you mentioned Bill Laswell, and it seems like coming into his orbit was a major breakthrough for you. So can you tell me how you met him and started working with him?
Okay, yeah. You know, at the height of the Peach Boys was playing everywhere. I couldn't walk out of my house. I couldn't walk up the street without hearing "Don't Make Me Wait" or "Life Is Something Special." And as I said before, the Peach Boys were slowly, you know, disintegrating.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw it coming. And I hate conflict, I hate arguing, so I just said, you know what, I'm gonna give them enough rope to hang themselves, and when I can find a way out of here, I'm out of here. So before I was out of there, I get a call from a cat by the name of Roger Trilling. Roger Trilling at the time was Bill Laswell's, you know, man Friday, or right hand man.
Mm-hmm.
And he's set up a meeting, and you know, They were gonna be. They wanted me to sing on some material stuff. That was the name of that was the name of the project at the time. You know, Bill Laswell and Michael Beinhorn at the time.
Yeah.
And so I go to the studio. We meet at the studio, and I'm trying to remember this correctly, because, you know, around that time, a lot of things were going on. Music was going on. A lot of things were going on. A lot of different clubs. We would hang out at the Roxy. Maybe I met Bill at the Roxy. I'm not sure, but I think it was Roger Trillick who called me. And I met Bill and Michael. We sat down, we talked. They played some stuff for me. They wanted, you know, me to sing the songs. I did sing the songs. I think it was two songs. I'm the One. And I need to think about the title of the next song. But I don't want the song I'm the One. A bad. I thought it was a great track. So, you know, the Peach Boys and Peach Boys are all over the airwaves now. This other song comes on the airwaves. I'm the One, and of course, Peach Boys were pretty pissed off. You know, now they don't have Bernard exclusive anymore. I'm singing with material, and. That pissed them off, but I was pissed off at them, you know, for stealing my money. So I didn't care what they thought.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, as that's going down, I'm still just trying to navigate my way around this new music era, you know. And we were hanging out at the Roxy and you know, the Peppermint Lounge, you know, Dance Fever, you know, we were hanging out at all the clubs that were happening at the time. Everybody was there. Me, Bill Laswell, Roger Trillis, Larry Fishburne, Madonna, Fab Five, Freddie, you know, we were all at the hip clubs. Also around this time, I was part of an all-black rock band called Sirius with Ronnie Drake and J.T. Lewis.
It's funny you mentioned that, because Melvin Gibbs told me to ask you about that band.
That's right. So we were playing all the other places, the other clubs like Max's Kansas City, CBGB's. You know, we're hanging out with the. With Andy Warhol and, you know, Debbie Harry crowd, and we were the first all-black rock band, you know, on the scene. Well, probably besides the Bus Boys, you know, Living Color. I mean, Vernon Reed used to come and see us. And again, you know, that was a heartache to quit. And then the Black Rock Coalition started. We played at the first Black Rock Coalition gig. I can't remember why, but we never quite could keep that together. And the Black Rock Coalition came, and Living Color group. They met Mick, and they got signed, and they were doing a record. And, you know, it was a great time. It was a strange time because we looked at Living Color as being successful, and they were breaking the door down for the rest of us Black Rock members.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't happen, of course. The Peach Boys broke up, and I was hanging out with Bill Laswell, and Bill Laswell was opening my mind up to a lot of other shit. A lot of other music, a lot of other players, and
became kind of one of his pool of collaborators, because you were on Herbie Hancock Records, Sly and Robbie Records, you were on the Public Image album, which the story there, I'm curious about that, because the story there is that I've heard is that Laswell basically completely took that album over from John Lydon and like handed him a finished record. I mean, is that how it was? So did you have much interaction with any of the actual quote-unquote members of Public Image or anything? Or,
well, I'm gonna tell you, I don't know about that, because I know Bill said that he was gonna be doing, you know, this Public Image record, and I didn't see anybody. The only person from Public Image I spent any time with was John.
Mm-hmm.
There was nobody else from Public Image that I saw. And I'd go to the studio when Bill was building tracks, and it was an incredible time. I mean, like I said, Bill was opening my head up. He just split my head wide fucking open. He split my head wide open. He called me and said, "Hey man, yeah man, I'm doing this Pill record." I'm like, "No shit." He said, "Yeah, I want you to be John Lydon's vocal coach." I'm like, "What?" "Yeah man, he needs some help, man. I need you to be his vocal coach." And I remember thinking when he said that, I'm like, "Fuck, how the fuck am I gonna be John Lydon's vocal coach? That's John Lydon, you know, there's only so much you can do to that. I mean, you can't change it, it is what it is." And what I found a way, not so much to be his coach, but just help give him pointers on how to, you know, string, how to sing stronger, or how to breathe and stuff like that, or, you know, how to phrase.
Yeah, like to make him a better version of himself, because you can't turn him into a soul singer or something, you know.
Exactly, a better version of himself. And I was so happy that I realized that, you know, or else I'd have been pulling my fucking hair out. But it worked out really good. And you know, I wasn't there for all of the tracks, but you know, I did get to see Ginger Baker. I got to see and meet Ginger Baker just getting into town. I got to see and talk to Tony Williams, and talk to Tony Williams about the rock band that he was going to start, and I was going to be the singer. I mean, it was an incredible freaking time, man. I remember walking into the studio, and I hear this fucking guitar shit, and I walk in as this young cat. Well, he looked young. He was in the fucking, in the booth, you know, playing, and I'm like, I looked around and they're like looking at me, because I'm just standing there in shock listening to this guitar, and they're all looking at me smiling and shit, and I'm like, "Who the fuck is that?" "Yo man, Steve Vai." I'm like, "What?"
Yeah, that's right. Back then, he wasn't Steve Vai. He was like just the guy who had been in Zappa's band a little bit.
Exactly. That's exactly right. That's exactly what they said. You see, "No, man, this is Steve Vai from Frank Zappa's band." I'm like, "What?" And I remember just standing there and watch Steve fucking lay those tracks, and I was fucking in awe. And then came my turn. And me and John would walk around the city together. You know, and I loved hanging out with John. John would just stir anybody's pot. You know, but just saying, you know, just whatever was in his head. He got a couple holes in his filter, but he's always taking the piss out of people. And he would get off on, you know, I'm sure what was him was joking, and watch people get upset about him joking.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the time, and like I said, Sirius, I mean, it was a killer band. killer band, but again, you know, people have to make the donuts, so you got to go wherever you can do that. So Sirius never took flight, which was unfortunate, because there was definitely something there.
Yeah. Now, a lot of these things, like the Hancock session, the PIL session to a degree, but like the Sly and Robbie albums that you were on also, it seemed like the same kind of pool of players. So would you just get a call from Laswell and be like, can you be here on Tuesday? We're doing so-and-so's album. Or how would it work?
No, that's exactly how it worked. I'd get a call probably from... well, if it wasn't Bill himself, it would have been Roger Trilling. You know, his man Fred there. And, you know, yo, man, we're going to be doing this, da-da-da-da. And, you know, come to the studio. And I'd go to the studio, and, you know, and Sly and Robbie would be there. And, you know, Bill was doing a lot of tracks out of, I think, a place called OAO. It was a studio in Greenpoint. Greenpoint, a studio run by Martin Beese. So a lot of the tracks would be cut there. You know, it wasn't the prettiest studio, but the sound coming out of it was incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
The sound coming out was incredible. And, you know, I'd get to the studio, you know, get to the studio, you know, well, I don't think I did the vocals. I think I might have did the vocals for the Sly and Robbie stuff on Quadrasonic or Quadrophonic in Midtown. And it was myself and Rommel Z was on there, but he did his before I did my. It was me and Gary Mudbone Cooper from Common Funkadelic.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
And the same, you know, and it was also me and Mudbone that did the vocal stuff for Bootsy Collins. What's Bootsy doing? I think that's the name of the record.
Yeah, the one he did in like 86.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, so, you know, I'm a kid in the candy store, man. Bill was introducing me to all my heroes.
Uh-huh.
All my heroes, you know, and Bernie Worrell, of course. And, you know, I love telling this, but, you know, I didn't set out to be a vocalist. It's just something that happened. I got kicked off the basketball team for singing in a band, so I pretty much, you know, decided to go for it. But a week after I auditioned for my first band, I was in a recording studio. I was in Media Sound Studio, one of the best studios in New York City, recording an album with this band. And I remember walking into the studio, you know, green. Never been in a recording studio, but, you know, I was into music heavily. And I told somebody this just the other day. I walked into Media Sound, and as I'm walking into the studio we were working in, a studio door opens and John Thomas comes out. And I'm like, oh, I'm like, damn. Fattis. And I'm like, hello, Mr. Fattis. Hey, brother, how you doing? Blah, 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 blah. I mean, I'm like, you know, I'm this young cat with these big eyes. I know he must have said, man, this cat is, he ain't never been in an environment like this before. He must be. So I said hello to him, and then I kept walking. And as I'm walking in, there's this cat in full buckskin pants, buckskin jacket, buckskin boots. And I'm like, he just looked like the coolest motherfucker I ever seen. And I'm walking over, and I get closer, and I start slowing down my walks because I want to see who this is. And just as I got up to him, he picked his head up. It was Bernie Worrell. And I knew Bernie were real because I was P-Funk crazy. I was Parliament Funkadelic crazy.
Uh-huh.
And I remember saying hi to him. He didn't look too well. He didn't look too well, but he did speak to me. So, yeah, I'm just having a memory of that time.
Man. How did you come to join Tackhead? Because I loved their early singles, but it was a big change when they kind of transformed into a quote-unquote real band with you singing and more traditional songs and stuff. So tell me about, you know, how that happened. Because I guess they just signed to a new label. So was the label intent on taking them in a more traditional route, or what happened?
Well, Tackhead, well, really, what I think is that Tackhead had spent so much time underground that Tackhead wanted to be above ground.
Mm-hmm.
And how I got there, okay. Mick Jagger. You know, Bill Laswell introduces me to Mick Jagger. Like, okay, I was singing with Herbie Hancock.
Uh-huh.
I was singing with Herbie Hancock. Had a break from the Herbie tour. This is during, you know, his rocket success. And I go to London. I meet Mick. I do Mick's first solo record.
Mm-hmm.
Few years later, I'm in New York, you know, getting ready to put together, you know, an all-star band, you know, with Carmine Rojas, and we're preparing to go to Avignon to do a gig, and so we're in SIR rehearsing. Somebody, before I get to SIR, somebody calls me and says, "Yo, man, Jagger is looking for a male singer to go on the road, and he's been auditioning people. Have you auditioned for that gig?" And I'm like, "No, I never heard anything about that." So I'm in SIR rehearsing. I'm going to the bathroom, and this entourage of people will come walking down the corridor, and in the middle of the entourage is Mick. So, as you know, I had done a solo record, what, 2 years or 3 years before that, so I'm like, "Hey, Mick, how you doing?" And he didn't say anything to me, so it kind of upset me. And
yeah.
And you know, somebody comes and asks me to audition, and she gives me this cassette tape and lyrics, and I leave, and I say, "Fuck that, I ain't auditioning." And Carmine Rojas, bless his heart, you know, takes me aside and says, "Hey, man, I understand how you feel, but you know what? Whether you take the gig or not, you need to go do that audition." So I went, I did the audition, and then, you know, they hired me pretty much.
Uh-huh.
They hired me. But when I walked into that audition, it was, you know, all the A-list cats, Simon Phillips, Jeff Beck just quit, but Joe Satriani's there, Jimmy Ripp is there, Doug Wimbish is there. So I get the gig, and, you know, we're rehearsing, and Doug had said to me, "Yo, man, I'm playing at the Ritz with Tackhead, you know, come on by." And I'd never seen Tackhead. I heard of Tackhead, but I'd never seen Tackhead.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and saw Tackhead play. I was blown away. And I remember thinking, they need a singer. They need a singer. They're, you know, it's all samples, but there's no singer to carry, you know, a melody from. It's just straight up groove music.
Yeah.
And so after the gig, I saw Doug in the Jagger rehearsal the next day. Oh, that night that I saw Tack Head play, they played a song. They played a song called Dangerous Sex.
Okay.
And Melon Mel from the Furious Five rapped it. So when I saw Doug the next day, I said, yo, man, I could sing that song. I can sing that song. I can make that a song. So after the Jagger gig, I get a call from Winbish. He says, yo, man, can you come to London? You know, I get to London. And that's when my, I get to London and the next thing, and the next thing I know, I'm fucking there for like 2 years. I'm in London 2 years. We actually got a deal. We got signed to, I think we got a publishing deal, but we got signed to a company called, a brand new label called SPK.
Yeah, yeah.
They signed Tackhead, Wilson Phillips, and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. We go to the office and, oh man, we got big things planned for you guys. Big things planned for you guys. We get to New York, you know, Tackhead gets to New York and we play a gig downtown. There's a club near the Roxy. And we slayed him. That's probably one of the best gigs we had ever played. Everybody was there. We were spitting fire. And then, you know, next thing we know, Doug and Skip were off to produce the Booyah Tribe, and they go to see the label in L.A. and they go to the office and the people are like, who are you? You know, the Tackhead and some woman, this is what I think I remember they told me, some woman says to them, Tackhead, and she, I guess she looks over her shoulder, she says, nobody call you guys? She said, I don't know. She said, obviously you guys don't know, but you guys have been dropped.
Oh, man.
Dropped? We just getting started. And that just killed us. It killed us. It took all the wind out of our sails.
Mm-hmm.
You know, plus the fact that there was some, you know, inner turmoil with Tackhead between, you know, some guys. And, you know, there was some people that wanted just to remain this underground groove, and you know, didn't see the potential of me being there.
Mm.
And so we did I think what two albums.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it was, you know, and that was it. Now, Doug went and joined Living Color.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then I had the Stones gig, and you know, people are off doing their own thing.
What was, I mean, because they're obviously both guys with a deep passion for dub, but how would you contrast Bill with Adrian Sherwood in terms of how they work in the studio?
Because
I've never talked to anybody that's worked with Adrian. I've talked to a lot of people who've worked with Bill, but
Adrian is a more hands-on guy. Bill is a master of putting people together. He's a master of putting people together, and he knows how to get the best out of people. He knows how to get a good performance out of people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some producers talk too much. Bill Laswell talks enough. He talks just enough. He knows how to make it, let it happen, or and if it's not going a certain way, he'll know how to get it to go that way. You know, Adrian, like I said, is a more hands-on, and Bill is really musical, whereas Adrian is really tone deaf. he's tone deaf, but you know, he kind of knows what he wants, and Adrian is also, I think, limited to a certain style and type of music, where Bill is fast.
Mm-hmm.
Bill is fast. I mean, I don't think there's a genre of music that Bill can't appreciate and can't make happen if he wanted to.
Yeah.
Whereas Adrian is more into, you know, Jamaican dub. You know, I don't think Adrian knew anything about funk until he met Skip McDonald, Doug Wimbish, and Keith LeBlanc.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now you...
Because Adrian didn't know what to do with me.
You sang on two tracks on the first Living Color album, and then you sang again on their third, which I guess was after Doug had joined the band. So... How did you, I mean, I guess you knew those guys from Black Rock circles and from, you know, like you said, from Vernon coming to Sirius gigs and stuff. But I guess what I'm curious about is your voice is close to Corey Glover's, but you have very different styles. He always sounds more like a Broadway singer than a rock and roll singer to me. So, I mean, what's your take on the difference between the two of you, and how did you work with him?
I would say that you're pretty close to being spot on in your description. I think you know, I've appreciated a lot of different types of music for a long time. Corey's younger than I am. I used to listen to rock and roll when I was growing up. Rock and roll was not a fad to me. I didn't jump on a bandwagon. When I looked for Sirius, I was looking to join a rock band. And it was my cousin, Mike Murphy from The System, and Lala Cope, who wrote You Give Good Love for Whitney Houston.
Mm-hmm.
I told them I was looking for a rock outfit, and they're the ones who put me in touch with Sirius. They're the ones that put me in touch with Ronnie Drayton.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always been part of my musical arsenal. Rock and roll was always a part of my musical arsenal. So I think that would probably be the difference between Corey and I.
And what was your broader involvement with the Black Rock Coalition in the 80s?
Say that again.
What was your involvement more broadly with the Black Rock Coalition in the 80s? Were you playing a lot of their benefits and shows and stuff like that?
Well, you know, we were one of those, you know, Black Rock bands that couldn't get anybody's attention. So, you know, we became supporters of it. We just supported it. We played we played the first Black Rock Coalition gig. We played the very first one. And after that, I think I was off, you know, in Tackhead Land or Stones Land or something, because as far as I remember, I think that might have been maybe one or two Black Rock Coalition gigs I had ever played. You know, and I remember there was even a time where Vernon had asked me to sing for Living Color. I think, I'm not sure where Corey was or what he was doing, but Vernon had asked me to sing for Living Color, but I couldn't do it. I was off doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
So, me or, you know, the band Sirius, you know, our involvement with the Black Rock Coalition was pretty limited. That was Vernon's baby.
Yeah.
That was Vernon's baby.
Yeah. So at what, it was about what, 89, 90 or so when you got the first, when you started singing with the Stones on tour?
Yeah, something like that.
Is there a kind of fraternity among sort of yourself and other people who tour and record with the Stones but are not, you know, quote unquote Rolling Stones themselves, and then people who have similar positions in other bands? Because there's, you know, there's a lot of like famous bands that have a whole crew that, you know, is part of the show but is, you know, not
right,
not quote unquote
right,
band members. So I mean, do you all sort of know each other on the global touring circuit?
Yeah, we all knew each other, you know, on the Illuminati. Yeah, we all, you know, it's something I just thought about was after Tackhead, you know, we were talking about, you know, me being, you know, me and Corey, and, you know, he's more like kind of throwaway thing, and my thing's a little different. After, let me think about this. After, after Tackhead, you know, was kind of, you know, fell apart, Bill Laswell called me and had me come to the studio. He was producing a record with Bootsy Collins, Buddy Miles, and Stevie Salas.
Wow.
I think it was Stevie Salas's project that Bill Laswell was producing. And I meet Stevie Salas in the studio. I thought he was Mexican, but, you know, he's Native American. But, I just met this cat, you know, from California, ball of energy, you know. California vibe, New York vibe's a little different.
Yeah.
And so I go to the studio and I do some singing on this project, and I'm gone. I leave again. I'm doing whatever else. And then I get a call from Stevie Salas asking me if I would sing a track on one of his records. So I did that. And then he calls me later, you know, time goes by, he calls me later, and he's like, yo, man, I want to do a project with you. Let's put together a band, okay? Let's do this thing. And so we, you know, we get together and we start writing. And it's feeling really good. And we put together this project called Nickel Bag. Nickel Bag. Now, I mean, compared to all the other rock stuff that I had been doing, this shit was happening.
Uh-huh.
This was happening. We recorded a whole album. The album was called 12 Hits and a Bunk. And it was, you know, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, you know, it's, you know, as all that stuff is going on, here's Nickel Bag. And I told Stevie when we were doing the record, the record was killer. I don't know if you have ever heard it, but if you haven't, you should. It's a bad-ass record. And for a second, I thought that was going to be the thing that put both Stevie and I over. I uh-huh. thought for sure that this was going to happen. And when we were doing the record, we're doing the pictures for the album. I told him, we can't do that. We can't do that. It's like, what do you mean? I said, listen, let's take these pictures, but call the makeup person in, and let's just paint our faces silver. Because if they see who we really are, it's going to be a problem for us.
Uh-huh.
And he thought about it, and he's like, okay, let's go. I'll go with you. So we put this silver paint on our face, We took the picture that was on the cover. And we started to get some traction. I remember Stevie calling me and saying, yo, man, I got a call from Sammy Hagar. Sammy Hagar said he was listening to the radio and heard some shit on the radio. He's like, what the fuck is that? And he's like, who the fuck is Nickelback? And he did some homework and found out it was Stevie, and he called Stevie. I said, I just heard your shit on the radio. That's some badass shit. So we were getting some traction. And we're doing gigs. I remember going, you know, the year that fucking, what was it? The Comet, Hail Bop.
Mm-hmm.
I remember we were driving through the desert in Nevada on a tour bus and stopped and looked at it. I remember we're going to a gig. We pull up to the gig and all these kids are outside. And we're walking off the bus and these kids are saying, yo, man, where's the singer? Where's the singer? I want to meet the singer. And I didn't say anything. And Stevie said, there he is right there. And the kid looked at me and he froze. He said, you... So yeah, and then that confirmed what I was telling Stevie. Let's not put our faces on it. I almost felt like we should have just kept doing the records without anybody seeing us. And then Stevie's doing some radio show with some radio cat, and the cat forgot. To put the press the mute button, and it's like, Nickelback, blah blah blah, and Stevie heard the fucking guy say. He heard the guy say, "Well, I don't know if we got enough room in rock and roll for another black front man."
Huh.
Stevie heard that, and he called me, and said, "Yo, B man, we don't have a problem." And told me what happened. I remember crying and hanging up the phone, because I said to him, I knew this was going to happen. I knew it was going to happen. The minute that they see that I'm black and he's fucking Indian, that we're going to have a problem. And it caused a problem. It was a soul crusher to me. And I was done.
Yeah.
I was, you know, so I had to go on and, you know, regroup and find my way.
Now, let me ask you about your solo stuff, because your first two albums, Friends with Privileges and The Burra, are both kind of, you got a lot of guest stars, a lot of, you know, people that you've played with from Herbie's band, from Tackhead, people that were in the Stones, like all sorts of people from all over guesting on this track or that track. So, I mean, when you work on a record for years with all sorts of different people coming in and playing on it and stuff, is it a challenge to bring it together and turn it into a unified artistic statement?
Yes and no. First of all, I never wanted to do that. I wanted to be in a band. I never thought about doing solo stuff. Never. Never. You know, I never wanted to. You know, I had a quick run with Chris Blackwell and Island Records, where he was, trying to help me develop, you know, the solo thing, and that went bad, and I didn't want it. I wanted to be in a band.
Uh-huh.
So I was doing gigs, and, you know, the business had changed, and, you know, I wanted to sell CDs at the shows that I was doing, so, you know, the first solo record, that's why, you know, I did, Friends with Privileges, the first solo record.
Uh-huh.
That's why I did that record, was just to have something to sell at the end of the gig. And as I'm recording the record, you know, I'm realizing because it was going to be all covers. It was going to be a whole cover record. And, you know, it started getting good, and I thought, well, you know, maybe I need to put, you know, some of my own songs on it. I did, and, you know, it was what it was. It was a little all over the place, I thought, you know, Prince with Privileges. Because, again, I didn't really want to do it. But then the second record, the Bura, because Friends of Privileges were, I thought, was a little too wide, I wanted the next record to be just a little more focused. And that was the Bura. It was more focused, more cohesive, I thought. I thought it was a beautiful record. I hate that it didn't get enough ears on it when it came out, but I think it was a beautiful record. But to get back to your question, which I just lost, what was that question? Do I think
just about how to make it a unified statement when you've got all these, you know, when you record a track here and a track there for 2 years, you know, rather than like blasting into the studio for 2 weeks or something.
Right. Well, you know, it was spread over that time because I had to go make the donuts, and I had to make donuts to pay for that record.
I'm
lucky to have a really, really good friends, both Rick and Lee Bench, my boys that own the Steakhouse Studio. And I bought in another cat. I bought in this guitar player that I had met. Somebody asked me to do some stuff for him, and I love the way he played. It's great vibe. And that cat is Robert Davis. Robert Davis, I bought in to co-produce the Bura with me. And I was glad to have him in the chair next to me, because I think it worked. I think it works really well.
So the new record, when did you start working on Inside Out? And was this kind of Gil Scott Heron, Last Poets sort of approach? This was the plan all along?
It was the plan all along. As a matter of fact, when I was recording... When I was recording the Bura, I said to Robert Davis, I said, man, I got to think about, you know, my next project. And I said, I remember saying to him, man, I'm thinking of doing a spoken word record. And he said, are you sure, B? he said, it sounds cool. And, you know, then I left. I left that thought, and, you know, and I'm finishing up the Bura. And as it got closer to the end, I'm thinking about what I want to do next. Because, you know, Friends with Privileges, the Bura, I thought were, you know, they're a little similar. You know, the Bura is a lot more cohesive. But, you know, I wanted to do something different. Now, I'm a solo guy. I'm a solo guy, and I love music. I don't like one type of music. I don't like one type of genre. I have an appreciation for all types. But my next project was going to be really different from Friends and Privileges and the Bura. So when I finished the Bura, I think maybe a month later, I went into the studio and started messing around with ideas. And, you know, I'd have to go away, you know, to do stuff, and then I'd come back and I'd go to it, and, you know, I had a good bit of time, and now I'm, you know, really in it. I called Walfredo Reyes and had him come by the studio, and we talked about different rhythms from Africa, South America, and he, you know, I told him what I was what I was going to do, and he was looking at me, like, you know, like the dog when you make a sound and he turns his head sideways.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I felt like Walfredo was looking at me when I told him what I was thinking about doing. And so we started the process, and the record was only supposed to be percussion and voice. That was it. But then as I started to get into it, you know, I thought, you know what? I don't know how people would react to just hearing voice and percussion. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to do some with I'll do a few tracks with the rhythm section. So I made the call to Vince Wilburn. I said, Vince, I need to record some stuff. He said, well, come over to the house, you know. What we doing? So I'll tell you when I get there. So I called him and called the guitar player George Evans, and called Daryl Jones. Got them over to Vince's house and told him what I was, you know, what I was gonna do. And he said, okay, well, you know, what are we gonna do? Where we start? And I was like, I just give them an era. I give them an era, a time in history. Or I'd give them a movie reference.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew exactly. And, you know, the great thing about that is that the three of them are from Chicago. And Vince and Daryl have played together a lot. I think they might have been, yeah, they played with Miles together.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So they know each other. And so I got them to, you know, just play grooves. And whenever they hit a certain spot, I would say stop. That's where we are. That's the groove that we're gonna build on. And that happened. So then once I had those rhythm tracks recorded, like, something's missing. And it's funny, I realized after recording the Bora, like before the Bora, whenever I was in the studio doing anything, I take it home, and I'm listening to it at home. I'm listening to it wherever I am, in the car, da 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 da. But this time, I'd leave it. When I left the studio, I left it.
Huh.
I left it. I wouldn't hear it until I got back to the studio. And I think that served me well. It served me well because it kept everything fresh. And there's a certain spontaneity, you know, that was happening. So when I listen to the rhythm tracks, I'm like, yeah, there's something missing. There's something missing. And that missing was rhythm guitar. And, you know, in particular, there was this one track where I was hearing a wah-wah guitar. And so I'm like, you know, I need rhythm guitar. Who am I freaking going to call? So I had been doing some stuff with Steve Jordan, and I had met Ray Parker Jr., you know, a few years back. So Ray lives in L.A., so I called him. I said, Ray, I need some rhythm, man. Okay, well, send me. He calls me and he says, you know, Bernard, you might want to call Wawa. Wawa Watson. But no, Ray, I want you. He's, you know, he was gracious, and then, you know, he said, okay. Came by Vince's studio, plugged in, you know, no fuss, plugged in and started playing that rhythm, and he pretty much finished the track. Once I heard him play that rhythm, it was done. I just had to find the right lyrics to go over it.
Now, yeah, I want to ask you about the lyrics, the songs that you chose for this album, because, you know, I noticed there's a version of Undercover of the Night on there, which is, you know, it was a hit, but it's not like a song that people think of as like a classic Rolling Stones song. And I'm also curious, whether you gave any consideration to doing Brown Sugar, because that's a lyric that a lot of people have had a lot of problems with since it was new, but especially like later on, decades later. And I'm curious what your take on it is.
Well, definitely not Brown Sugar, because it was too popular.
Ah, okay.
Definitely not. I didn't want to do or use any of their popular stuff. I wanted to go into the catalog. The only song that I knew that I would do was Undercover of the Night. That's the only song I knew I would do.
Mm-hmm.
And it came, you know, and that came, you know, very early in the recording process. So I'm helping create these rhythms. And I'm not sure what I'm going to put over it. So I had to go into the songbook, Rolling Stone songbook, volume 1 or volume 2. I'm not sure, but I just started thumbing through the pages. Even as Daryl and Vince are making these grooves, I'm thumbing through the pages, you know, reading the lyrics to see how it flowed when I read them.
Huh.
And, you know, after, you know, as I'm reading them, I could feel it. I could feel what flowed. And I thought, oh, shit, okay, got one. Time waits for no one. Tick-tock. It flowed. It had a flow to it. It felt good. And that's how I started choosing the lyrics that I would use. You know, spoken word is a really, really funny thing. And, you know, I'm realizing, like, there's, you know, that genre is out there. When I was making Inside Out, that never crossed my mind. I thought I was the only one. I thought everybody had forgot. But since I found out that, no, people are doing it. But the thing is, the difference is that I won't say most, because I've not heard most, but a lot of it, the music and the lyrics are disjointed. And what I mean is, first of all, the delivery of the lyrics are not always, it's not always delivered in a palatable way.
Yeah, because there's that sort of, I've seen it referred to as poetry reading voice. That's very standardized.
Referred to it as what?
As poetry reading voice. And it's done, okay, no matter what you're actually saying, they all have the same sort of poetry reading cadence. You know.
Right. And the music and the lyric are not together. The music in a lot of the stuff that I heard is just a freaking backdrop. It's just a backdrop.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what separates Inside Out, and I think it, well, it's song lyrics that I'm delivering in a poetry form. And I also think the fact that I'm a singer helps to join the music and the lyric together.
Yeah. But it's also, it's very interesting to me what you said about how you created the musical tracks first and then decided what set of lyrics worked best with them, rather than saying, okay, I'm going to do this song and then creating a musical backdrop for it. Because that's why, you know, you don't hear the riffs from these songs from your backing band. It's a completely new and different arrangement, which is one of the things that I think makes it so fascinating.
Right.
So, I mean, everybody loves the late 60s and early 70s run from the Stones, but do you have, like, since you're sort of on the inside, you know, obviously for many years now, do you have, like, a latter-day Stones album that you think doesn't get its due?
Yeah, there is. Let me think about this. I'm thinking maybe it's Voodoo Lounge.
Mm-hmm.
It's either Voodoo Lounge or Bridges to Babylon. It's one of those records.
Huh. Okay.
It's one of those records. I mean, you know, shit, man. I think that, you know, the Stones catch hell from their fans. They catch hell from their fans. Their fans only want to hear the shit that they know.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, the minute they try to do something, you know, new, I mean, they accept it, but, you know, I guess, you know, the people that are fans that play their material, you know, they'd rather play the old stuff. Which is a shame, because they've done some pretty cool things, and, you know, and their solo records, I mean, Main Offender was a motherfucker.
No, it was, yeah. Main Offender is a good record, and it goes back to what I was talking about before. It feels like one thing all the way through.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's not a patchworky type of record. It's like Keith
That's
and the band
right.
were just like, we're gonna do 10, 11 tunes, and they're all gonna sound like this. Let's go. You know,
that's right. That's a brilliant record. The record I produced for Ronnie Wood, Slide on This, I thought is a killer record. And, well, all of Charlie's jazz records I love, but Jagger's solo record, Goddess in the Doorway, I thought it was a great record, just really bad timing with, you know, 9/11.
Mm.
9/11 killed that record, but I thought that was a pretty good record.
Okay, that was my conversation with Bernard Fowler, and that's the end of this episode of the Burning Ambulance podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, and if so, I hope you'll consider becoming a subscriber on Patreon at patreon.com/burningambulance. It's just $5 a month, and it'll really help us to improve the content on the website and on the show, and maybe even start creating some exclusive content just for subscribers. So visit patreon.com/burningambulance and throw us $5 a month if you can. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you'll come back for the next one. Osiris.